to summarise, the fishing I had in Lake Eucanbeen in mid to late December was the best lake fishing I've had in my lifetime. Now, that's a big statement, but I'll explain.
G'day and welcome to another instalment of the Fly Fishers podcast.
Since 1967, we've been spreading the bug of fly fishing at our Melbourne Fly Shop.
Join us as we celebrate the fun of fly fishing and chat with characters that enjoy it as much as we do.
Whether you're just starting out or have some experience, we hope our ego-free commentary helps demystify fly fishing and inspires you to visit new places and try new techniques.
What a season it's been.
It has, hasn't it? That's, you know, another one nearly gone.
Crazy.
It happens so fast, doesn't it? And we say it all the time, but it gets to the end and you're like, God, I just didn't fish enough.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's never enough.
Yeah, that's right.
But the two of us, we did have some fun out there and found tough fishing, found good fishing, found average fishing. So it was variable.
Super variable, like varied day to day, like crazy, I reckon.
Yeah.
One customer comes through the door, they had the worst fishing session of their life. And then the next customer walks in 20 minutes later and they caught a dozen fish in a couple of hours.
Yeah.
So
just the incredible contrast between reports. But overwhelmingly, the people that fished did pretty bloody good.
Yeah, absolutely. And it really cranked up towards the end. I'd say the last 3 months have been amazing.
I think we might have given people a bit of a bum steer with our cormorants episode because for whatever reason, it was topical at the time and it certainly was a real problem in a few rivers. But there was a little bit of bad press out there, but it was amazing, you know, how many people made up their mind without actually getting out there and finding out for themselves.
Absolutely, I agree. I mean, I went out and I only saw one cormorant all season, yeah, which is crazy. And then there's other people that they've never seen a cormorant in their life. Mm. So,
and even if you did see them, it wasn't didn't mean that the fishing was going to be completely cooked in that area.
No, that's right. You just go to a different beat on the river or something, and then you start catching fish. It's
pretty
simple.
Or, you know, just stick to fishing in cover, and there is essentially a lot you can do when trout are being predated on by something like cormorants. And I think the more adaptable angler really did quite well this season. In fact, I, having a bit of a good feel, I think we can claim that we've got a pretty good feel of what's going on out there on the shop floor because of the frequency of customers that we have coming in. I reckon an average season, as in like, certainly not a bad season, more on the average side.
A standard trout season, Victorian trout season. It's very typical Victorian river conditions. They get low towards the end of the summer, a bit warm, gets to that point, and then it gets cold again and the fishing kind of kicks, has a second breath.
Yeah.
And, yeah, 100%. That's.
And we still had people coming in that had red letter days.
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
Right place, right time. It's fly fishing, you know, it's always going to be variable. And so overwhelmingly, I think a pretty positive season, despite the bad press.
And to make sense of it all, absolutely, we're going to hear from Philip Weigel shortly.
Yeah, can't wait for that. You know, like Phil, he did a lot of fishing this season. And as we've just touched on, the more those that were more inclined to really explore different areas and try different things and maybe have a bit of a plan in place as to how to deal with what was a situation, both climatically and with the cormorants. I really hope Phil can shed some light on that and we can, discover what Phil does during those times. So, yeah, it'd be good to chat to him.
Absolutely.
So let's give him a buzz and see how the great man is doing.
Let's talk a bit about the season that was, Phil. You seem to be on the water quite a lot. Do you think you fished as much as any other season?
Yeah, for sure. Yep, at least.
For the vast majority of people, it sounds like they've fished a lot less this season. Why do you think that is?
Well, partly because for the average angler, for want of a better term, I think there was a lot of bad news So it's really interesting with fishing, and it works both ways, I believe. Like, good news travels fast and bad news travels fast. So a bit like how social media operates, and probably that's part of the story, it amplifies a given situation. So if the fishing's a little bit tough, then social media and conversations and so forth turn that into very tough. And so people think, I'm not going to go. And it works the other way in a year like 2022, 2023. The fishing's fantastic. Well, it's probably hyped up to be even better than that, but it becomes a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy because people hear how great the fishing is on the Goulburn or at Eucombine or whatever. They all go out. They fish believing they're going to catch some, and guess what? They do. Yeah. So it works both ways, and I think the last 12 months or so has definitely been the former, that sense that, oh, God, cormorants, drought, da-da-da-da-da, I'm not going to catch any, so I won't go out, and if I do go out, I probably won't catch any anyway. And, of course, you're on a hiding's nothing if you get out of the car believing you're not going to catch any fish. You sure won't catch any doing that.
As far as like places to go, did you approach this season a bit differently as to where you fish, do you think? Or was it a pretty...
I always do, Andrew. So I reckon the number one thing you should never do as an angler is, oh, but we always go there. That sort of approach. Oh, but when we go to Tasmania, we always fish Little Pine. You know, so we're going to camp on Little Pine this year. Well, sounds like Little Pine was one of the two or three waters in Australia that was hammered the worst by the cormorants. So probably not a great plan. Now, I'm being hypothetical here.
Yep.
Or, you know, oh, I always fish the Hauka in February. Well, if the Hauka was low and warm in February, it's not the place to go. So you need to think through any year, not just this last 12 months, any season, you need to think through where you're going. Where has there been rain and where hasn't there been rain? Where's it been really hot? Where's it been a bit more forgiving? And plan your trip accordingly. I always bang on about the fundamentals, and for me the fundamentals are a layer above, not below, what you read on Facebook. Trouble with Facebook and social media and so forth is you're getting an unfiltered, an unedited, an unqualified opinion. Now, so it can be useful, but I'd rather look at the fundamentals, i.e., where have there been good fish stockings? Where has there been good fish recruitment? And most importantly, where has there been a sustained period of good water levels and good rainfall and cooler temperatures? And across Victoria, the contrast was extraordinary over the last 12 months. Like eastern Victoria, green and lush and full of water, western Victoria heading towards a worst ever drought. So, you know, that it can come down to that sort of landscape scale, you know. And if you live in Melbourne or a city, no offence to people who live in Melbourne or Sydney or whatever, you're probably a little bit insulated from that sort of thing. Whereas if you live in the country and you're talking to farmers and so forth all the time, then you get a much better sense of how it's playing out. So that would be my number one piece of advice, as always, is by all means, listen to and read your social media reports, but recognise you're probably just getting the amplification that I'm talking about, where one bloke says, oh, gee, the cormorants have been bad, I can't catch any fish. And so another guy says, yeah, yeah, it's the same for me. Another one says, yeah, yeah, me too. And before you know it, you know, there's this kind of pile on with the bad news, as opposed to in a really good year where people go, hey, fantastic fishing on the Goulburn. There's 2 and 3 pound rainbows everywhere. And people race up to the Goulburn and sure enough, there are, and they catch them. And so they report that. And so you get the positive amplified in that direction. So it doesn't just work in one way, but I think if you look at what the levels have been, takes work. You have to look in, you have to go back through Bureau of Meteorology records and rainfall records and streamflow records. And if the fundamentals are good, that's an extremely good start. It's not perfect. There can be aberrations, but that's where I work from.
Right.
So I guess in summary, you're saying that this season, like every other season, presented some challenges. How did that look for you in terms of where you fished through the season? So let's say the opening of the season for you, where did you get to?
So I went up to the northeast because the drier than normal conditions, so the Goulburn catchment, for example, the drier than normal conditions were working to our advantage because streams that would normally be too high and too cold actually weren't too bad. And the Goulburn itself early on was really good. It was moderate flow, relatively mild weather, and the fishing was very solid. The lakes around me, the Central Highlands lakes, they were good too, although it was worrying how low they already were going into spring. But nevertheless, at that time, they fished very, very well. The Grampians the same. And of course, the Crater Lakes, always worth a go. So Bullamerri was exceptional early. Plenty of water. Well, it always had plenty of water. It's about 300 feet deep. The water quality was good. The fishing was good there. So early on, they were all good. There were, as the season wore on, things start to change. So if you like a headline of the first half of the year on the lakes around me was lack of duns. So it was a poor year for mayfly. We loved the duns, but they weren't great. Had our moments on Lake Windaree, but most of the other lakes, pretty average to poor for duns. And that happens. That's happened before and it'll happen again. So the mayfly were down. As an example of something that wasn't great, still could catch fish, but just not on mayfly.
Do you think that's so the lack of mayfly hatches? Do you think people going up to Wenderee expecting to have mayfly fishing, and then there's no mayflies? That's why they're not catching any fish. They're not willing to adapt.
Yeah,
to fish
definitely,
differently.
And look, hey, I love mayfly.
Everyone
just like
loves
the next
mayfly
person,
fishing.
But if I have to catch or I want to catch fish on Lake Wenderee, and the mayfly are scarce. Stick catters are really good, that in my experience. So when I went to Wenderee and there weren't any fish on mayfly, rather than just sitting on my ass waiting for the mayfly to hatch, I'd fish a stick catters and I caught fish. So you can still catch them. If you want to catch trout on mayfly, great. You know, I agree, it's fantastic fun, but I don't think you want to make your day live or die on whether the mayfly hatch. Even in a good year, there are days when they don't hatch, you know. So have your plan B. But that was definitely a thing last year, and was the lack of mayfly on the lakes around me. Yeah.
And that's just a variable every year, right? Like you're going to
It is. Yeah. It's never linear. So you never, ever have year after year after year of great mayfly fishing. You have good years, average years, and poor years, and this was a poor year. Which wasn't to say there weren't times when the mayfly were very good. We had a great pre-thunderstorm fish on Lake Wenderee, JD, Daniel, and I, and there was a good hatch, and the big fish got up on them and ate dry flies. So it was still possible for it to happen. It just didn't happen as often as it should. And it also didn't happen some days when you thought it should, when the conditions appeared ideal and it still didn't happen. So, yeah, and you've just got to, you know, fish another way or go home, I suppose.
Yeah. So the Goulburn and Wenderee, where else did you get to at that early season into spring?
So where else did I get to? It's all here in the diary. Grampians. So the Grampians were good. They were what I'd describe as solid. So Wartook, Belfield, and Fyans. They were basically par, I suppose you'd say. What you'd expect to happen would happen if you got the right weather. You could fish dry flies, beetles, midge, that sort of thing. If it was rough, just pulling wets, you'd catch them. So they were good. Yeah, so that was spring, really.
You didn't get up to the Snowy Mountains at all?
Yeah. When I say the Goulburn catchment, I don't just mean the Goulburn. I mean the Rubicon, the Stevenson, the Acheron, the Murrindindi, etc. But they were all good. But weird stuff happened. Like in September, the fish, and this was one thing I was going to mention as a, if you like, a headline for the season just gone. I have never seen so many dragonflies in September. It was just nuts. There were dragonflies everywhere. I'm not talking about lakes where they were as well, but the rivers. There were just dragonflies were just a big thing in September of all things. So in hindsight, you sort of wonder whether that had something to do with what was coming with the warm, dry conditions. But so we had to change the way we fished. So on the Goulburn and the Rubicon, we were stripping unweighted magoos over the top of dragonfly leapers like we would on the lakes if we were trying to catch them. So, you know, we're having 2-, 3-, 4-pound fish come flying out of the water to smash a magoo strip fast on a river. So, yeah, that was the weird sort of stuff that could happen.
So
in,
I think
in early spring. So that was, and I don't know if that'll ever happen again, you know, but when we saw it happening, we were throwing regular dry flies and nymphs around like we normally would, and we weren't catching a thing or hardly anything. But if we found a leaper and ripped a unweighted magoo across the top of it, getting that long, skinny dragonfly profile. Of course, we can't. We haven't got helicopter flies yet. Someone will make a lot of money if they invent one of them. But that's how we caught them.
So it sounds like the theme for this season was making sure you've got a plan B and a plan C.
Like
you said, it's not a season where you're heading up there.
And trying your best to go out with a positive attitude. It's so important. You don't realize just how important it is until you have a year like we've just had. So you don't know. Like I keep coming back to, you don't notice it in 2022 because everyone's expecting to catch a fish, so therefore they do.
Yeah,
it's really interesting. Yeah.
Do you think that was a bit of a stark reality for people this season after coming off the back of so many great La Niña years?
Yeah, I do, and look. Do not get me wrong. I love 2022. I love 23. The first half of 2024. But when the fishing was, if you like, in inverted commas, easy. But I still enjoy the problem solving of a season like we've just had. You know. But yeah, for people who get out, you know, a few times a year, I get that it would have been really hard to get your morale up, I suppose, before you headed out to fish. But it's the only way to do it. I don't have another answer for you. You know, read Flystream, read the reports, know that it's all vetted, what you're reading really did happen, and then go take a deep breath and say, righto, well, it can be done. I'll see if I can do it. But without expecting it to be 2022 or 2023, which were, by the way, some of, if not the best fishing years of my lifetime, you know. So
that puts it in perspective, doesn't it?
So moving into mid-season, Phil, where did you find yourself heading then?
So mid-season headed up to the Corryong area, and that was good, not great. And then went to the Snowy Mountains, and the Snowy Mountains were very good when we were fishing the rivers. Like the Upper Murrumbidgee was particularly good, really classic high quality stream fishing, you know, classic elk hair caddis and the odd fish on a nymph. Really good fishing, good fish, plenty of them, lots of dry fly. And then went to Lake Eucombeen. And here's where it gets really interesting, because to summarise, the fishing I had in Lake Eucombeen in mid to late December was the best lake fishing I've had in my lifetime. Now, that's a big statement, but I'll explain. We were fishing in bright sunshine in the middle of the day with great big dry flies like PMXs to Polaroided 4 to 7 pound brown trout cruising in 2 foot of water. And that went on day after day after day. It was that good that we hardly ever fished evening because we were so sort of pleasantly exhausted. Plus we'd caught so many fish, we didn't feel we needed to. Now, interesting aside to that is heading up to Eucombeen, the sort of murmur was the cormorants wrecked the fishing. So nothing could have been further from the truth. Like I say, it was as good as I've ever had up there. I mean, we've caught as many big fish in that flood year of 2022, I think it was, when the lake flooded ground that hadn't been under for ages and ages. There were plenty of big fish around. We were catching them on wets, though. We weren't really getting them on dries. So it was still really great, don't get me wrong. But to be able to sight fish to trout that big and fat and willing, it was just like some sort of fly fishing dream. It really was. And this happened day after day after day. If you had the light, you had the fish. So, you know, you never know what's around the corner. And that was an absolute stunner for us. And you know what? We ran into people up there when we were fishing it who were saying how bad the fishing was. So go figure.
Was there anything heading up there that gave you more confidence? Like, were you looking at reports from BOM and things like that, thinking, oh, this could be really good?
Well, the fundamentals were good. Like, strangely enough, the lake was very stable, so that's always a good thing. The water was very clear. It usually is there, but if there'd been, you know, torrential rain pushing muddy water into it, may not have been so much so. It was dumb luck that we got the it was dumb luck that we got the conditions, because I don't have the luxury of being able to sort of plan a Yukonbeen trip a couple of days out. So sure enough, if the weather had been not ideal, we would have fished elsewhere. We would have done more river fishing and so forth. But we had the blue sky, so we had the great visibility. The water temperature was up there a little bit, but not too bad. And because Yukonbeen so vast, it's kind of like a giant fridge. It takes a lot to heat it and it takes a lot to cool it down. So although the surface temperature can sometimes be up a little bit, you wouldn't have to go very far down to find the cold water. So anyway, the big brown trout were very happy eating insects in shallow water. And it was just mind-blowing. I mean, the first time I saw one coming, I thought, that can't be a fish. You know, when you're at Botsford or somewhere and you look out and you think, that can't be a fish. That must be a bit of weed. And then you realize it moves. Well, it was like that time after time after time, seeing these big dark shapes on a light sandy bottom and thinking, geez, that looks like a fish, but it can't be. You know, it's too good to be true. It's sort of midday. And then, sure enough, this giant sort of shape, when I say giant, but, you know, 2 foot long, would come down the bank and you'd chuck your fly out ahead of it and it'd just stick it, it'd come up to it, look at it and go, glump. And these were often big flies, like size 10 PMXs. We sort of put the equation together while we're up there that these aquatic moths were hatching in big numbers at night, and some of them were still on the water for various reasons early in the morning, and that basically is what we think got the fish looking up. And then as other food got on the water, like grasshoppers and beetles during the day, it kept them looking up. So there was a lot of dumb luck involved, but again, went out there expecting and hoping to catch fish. So the sort of self-fulfilling prophecy once again.
Yeah, and it sounds like it wasn't just a highlight of this season, but a potential best ever in terms of, trips to Yukonbeen, which is phenomenal.
Who would have thought, eh?
Yeah. In a season where so many people struggle.
In the dire season of 2024-25, I had what I do think is probably, all components considered, my best ever Tassie, New Zealand, whatever you want to, however you want to put it, best ever lake fishing.
Yeah, wow. And the rivers up in the area, what was the word on the street, I guess, when you were there? Were they fishing well?
The word was that they weren't fishing that well. I don't think it was quite like the cormorant thing was alive and well up there, but more I think we were hearing about it on the lakes, that's where the impact had been. And I do think, incidentally, that they had an impact, right? And don't for a moment think that when I'm not being dismissive of cormorants. I've said 100 times I hate them. I wish they didn't exist, and I don't like them. But, trout and cormorants have coexisted for millions of years, and cormorants eat them and knock them around, but trout have strategies to reduce the impact. And one thing we noticed at Eucanbeen, and it improved as the season wore on, was the lack of rainbows. So I suspect the rainbows being somewhat smaller and, for want of a better word, more careless, were more easily impacted by the cormorants, whereas stupid the big rainbows. Browns, ironically, weren't. You know, too big for the cormorants to eat, and this is just my surmising, and generally a more cryptic and careful fish when the cormorant activity was at its greatest early in the season.
It's time for a short break to talk about the legends who bring this podcast to life. Our committed team at The Fly Fisher prepare, record, and edit in-house in South Melbourne. We put huge effort in for you listeners. We hope that means when it comes time to make a fly fishing purchase, you consider us. With your loyalty, we can keep producing these podcasts and bringing you the world's best fly fishing gear. So shop smart and support the fly shop that supports you.
So summer, where else did you get to?
So Tassie in January, end of January, and that was really good, and sounding like a stuck record. We were told how terrible it was and it was all buggered and don't bother coming sort of thing. And there were six of us fishing on and off together. And on one particular day when the six of us sort of shared boats and banks and so forth, our best day was 75 fish. So I don't think you can classify that as bad fishing. It's certainly not bad fishing in my book anyway. So that was an average of 12 fish each. All good fish and mostly caught on dry flies, sight fished. So, you know, we just rolled our eyes sometimes. I think, again, from what we gathered, we didn't spend much time, if any, there. Little Pine was very tough, and I believe that. That's quite possibly it was. But one of the beautiful things about Tasmania is how many choices you've got. You've just got literally dozens and dozens and dozens of first-class lakes. And if one of them isn't fishing very well for whatever reason, low water, dirty water, whatever, there's usually another not far away. We found Great Lake to be very, very good. If the cormorants had eaten any trout out of Great Lake, it was hard to sort of measure it, because sometimes when we're out on the midges at sort of 10 o'clock in the morning, there were trout as far as the eye could see. It was extraordinary. So really, really fantastic dry fly fishing there. St. Clair was much the same. Craig and I, the fly tying writer for Flystream, were in a boat together on St. Clair, and we were having great fishing and thinking, gosh, you'd think of all lakes, this would be the one that would be punished. And then we went into this bay, and there was a sort of fallen tree that was black with cormorants. We thought, oh, here we go. This is where it all comes unstuck for us. And we were about to motor out of that bay, and about 300 metres from the cormorants, we noticed this big patch of fish jumping for black spinners, of which we caught a few. So, you know, it's funny how it works sometimes.
Did you find down in Tassie you had to adapt to your technique too much, or was it business as usual?
We probably didn't do a lot of is deliberately chase dun feeders. But having said that, we still found them. We found them on penstock, and we found them on Kay. And had good fishing with dry flies to fish taking duns. But we move around a lot anyway, Pete, in Tasmania. Like we enjoy trying the different lakes. And if we go somewhere and it's no good, so here's a thing. We heard really good reports about Lake Echo. So we love Lake Echo, and we headed over to Lake Echo. And the forecast wasn't what actually transpired. Basically, it was cold. So we got to Lake Echo, and there was this very cold wind blowing from down the lake, so it wasn't the direction we were hoping for. And we spent about an hour there, and maybe we were impatient, but we didn't see much at all, so we bailed. So we got, if you like, we got that wrong. But then we went to Binny and Dee and had really good fishing, both more sheltered, both somewhat warmer. And the difference was chalk and cheese. We had fish to cast too, and there were insects and so forth. So I suppose we adapted in that case to the conditions.
And what about the rivers, Phil? It sounds so far like the lakes have been a bit of a highlight for you this season.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Generally.
So the rivers look like I consistently caught fish in the Goulburn catchment. Moving out of summer into autumn, caught them in the Ovens catchment and the Kiwa. I reckon it was good fishing, and so did some of my mates. Other people said it was a disaster and there were no fish. Interesting article coming up very soon about the Ovens in Flystream, about some habitat work, and one of our writers sort of went to investigate and see if he found the bad reports to be as he'd heard, and he was able to find fish. So here's something else, right? I think this year, especially with low flows, you got to fish the habitat. So I was up on the Hauka and the Deltoid only a couple of weeks ago, and I think if you just fished all the water evenly, you'd struggle. But the fish are concentrated, or at least the catchable fish are concentrated, where there's a narrow low flow channel and where the cover is good. And that's probably not even a cormorant thing anymore. That's just a sort of low water thing. So, you know, you've got to spend time very, very carefully fishing the best bits. So that doesn't mean racing up the river, finding a narrow rapid or run, and then popping three flies into it and striding further up. It's a case of get to that bit of water and treat it like gold, and you may well find you get two or three or four fish out of it.
Did you go up to those two rivers with pretty low expectations just based on water level?
No, I didn't have low expectations because I looked at the fundamentals and thought it's very unlikely they've been wiped out. And the fish that have survived the cormorant onslaught will have had the river to themselves. So small fish will have grown very quickly. And that's pretty much how it played out. So we didn't encounter a lot of big fish, although we did encounter a couple. Didn't catch them, but saw them. But certainly lots of very fat sort of 12-inch browns and rainbows that were probably wouldn't have been that big had they not had the run of the place or had a lot more space than they would in a normal year. So that's just conjecture as well on my part, but that's what we found. And like I say, Andrew, they may well have been in the big dark pools, but I just think that's a really difficult, during daylight at least, it's a really difficult ask to catch them out of those sort of spots. So we found spots where they'd be feeding, and which was the, you know, like I say, the heads of those pools or the runs and the narrow runs and the rocky bits. Like rocky, tumbly water was gold, even if it was only 2 metres wide, you know. That's where they had cover and a nice sort of delivery of food, and that's where fished very, very well.
Do you think the oxygen levels in that kind of more turbulent water plays into it a little bit as well?
It would have earlier on. By the time we were there, the water was cold anyway, so it wouldn't have been a thing. But, yeah, for sure, during the middle of summer, those sort of spots are valuable also for the oxygen for the fish, especially the bigger ones. In fact, sometimes when conditions are really tough, you'll find the very biggest fish sort of nosed up into that kind of water. Having said that, sometimes those fish are stressed and won't eat. So I'm talking the outsized fish, the ones that you rarely see, the 3 or 4 pounders, they can be pushed right up into that tumbling oxygenated water just for the oxygen. So they're more interested in survival than feeding. But the small fish will be feeding happily in the same conditions. Just takes a lot more to keep a big fish happy with oxygen. So, yeah.
Do you have something, mate?
No, I was just going to – I just wanted to touch on, obviously, the water's been low. Do you think there needs to be a bit more of a focus on how we handle our fish and look after them too? Because I know in America
I think it always should be.
Absolutely.
So I think always I think if you're going to release a fish, always be careful with it. If the water's warm, you know, if you're going to lift it out of the water at all, make it for a moment, you know. Otherwise, just keep it in the water. Try not to sort of fight them for 3 hours on 7X tippet before you bring them to hand.
Yeah.
So, that's a thing of months gone by now. Like, there's no longer a factor. The water's, you know, super cold now. But, yeah, in summer, For sure, that's a thing. In warm, low water conditions, being careful with the fish is a good thing, but probably should be a thing always, I believe.
We've kind of touched on it a little bit already, but the fish condition and, you know, potentially fewer fish being in these systems, generally that being correlated to an improvement in the overall condition of fish as time goes on. Is that something you're pretty optimistic about in the next season?
Oh, very. And seeing, so on one river, which I won't name, in autumn, man, did I see hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of what I call young of the year, fish that are probably about, you know, 6 inches long. So too small to be a serious fishing target. And you don't often see a lot of fish like that because normally they're hiding from all the bigger fish. So this is the thing about trout. They're just fantastic at coming back from any kind of adversity. Now, there were some decent fish in that river too, enough to keep me happy, but I've never, ever seen so many young of the year. And I suspect the same would apply to the upper reaches of many of our streams. You know, there's a really good cohort of fish that have happily survived till now, and providing we return to something like normal flows going into next season, I expect the fish numbers will be really, really good. We're lucky with trout. They grow fast, you know. They grow really fast. Some of the growth rates that you see on lakes beg a belief. You know, you get trout increase in size tenfold in the space of a few months if the conditions are right. So I think, you know, what's a 6-inch, 10-inch fish now could really be a decent 1, 1.5, 2-pounder come spring, you know. Yeah. And so that's pretty exciting given that the numbers of those sorts of fish are very good.
Yeah, it's that fast. And, you know, probably the Great Lake is one that's looking a little bit exciting too because it's now had, you know, two seasons where natural recruitment you'd have to presume
has
been
quite
low.
That's it. I hadn't thought of that, but you're right. Yeah. Apparently the spawning stream flows aren't remarkable at the moment, and yet the fish numbers are very, very good. And the browns particularly will just live on, you know, they'll keep going and growing. So yeah, that's the sort of some sort of silver lining whenever there's a bit of predatory pressure or environmental pressure on fish numbers, the survivors have a lot more food. I mean, really, the irony is the New Zealand fishery that we so crave is basically built around exactly that. I mean, the mortality rate of young fish in most New Zealand rivers is horrendous. They're constantly being hammered by floods and outcompeted by bigger fish. So the result is low numbers of very, very large fish. Now, I don't for a moment suggest that that's what I want, but it is, whether we choose it or not, that is a function of fewer fish in some of these rivers than normal. So I'd rather have plenty of fish and then the odd big one myself. And I guess most of the listeners that would feel the same way. But in the meantime, when numbers are down, condition is on those rivers particularly where it's sort of dog eat dog, the size is going to be better than we're used to. And it's already been the case this autumn that I've been amazed at the condition of the fish on rivers like the Ovens and some of those Goulburn tributaries. You know, the fish are really chunky.
So when we talk about Goulburn tributaries, are we talking about most of the rivers around Marysville? So the Stevo?
Yeah, Marysville. So Stevenson, Acheron, Rubicon. Then above Lake Eildon, the Big River, that's been really good. To a lesser extent, of course, the upper Delatite's been very good. And then there's the Jammo and the Hawkwa and those. So it's a big system, basically.
Yeah, it is.
And I think and the Murrindindi, the King Parrot. I haven't fished the King Parrot much, so I can't give you a sort of expert opinion on that. But all the rest, that's been the basic trend, give or take. I mean, some of them have done really well in terms of overall sort of fish survival. Either the cormorants haven't got them or the water conditions have remained more favourable, and so those are the streams where fishing has been more business as usual. I'd kind of push the Rubicon into that category. That's probably one that I don't expect anything exceptional next season, because it's been good this season anyway. But yeah, the rivers like the Hauqua, perhaps parts of the Deltoite. What else? They're the sorts of streams where I'm expecting that come the new season, assuming we get good flows, there'll be a good number of bigger than normal fish.
I think there's a lot to be said for rivers like the Stevo and the Ruby. You know, they're some of the closest trout rivers to Melbourne, and they take an awful lot of angler pressure, but you still catch plenty of fish.
Yeah, you can, and it's testament, I suppose, to the fact that probably the people who fish those streams hardest let a lot of them go. They have to anyway on with the regulations on the Rubicon. So yeah, I think the fact that there's a lot of catch and release just goes to show, as you say, Pete, you can still have good fishing on what must be some of the most heavily fished per square metre water in Victoria.
That's right. Yeah. And I think a lot of people...
Hard to get your head around it sometimes, isn't it?
A lot of people tend to turn their nose up when we suggest those rivers in the shop, but they are some of the most productive rivers and, dare I say, easiest rivers to sort of figure out. Watch me go to the Stevo next week and not catch anything, but they are accessible and, you know, nice rivers to fish.
Absolutely. And in the, you know, Philip Weigel's book, Fly Fishing Northeast Victoria, they're excellent on the excellent Philip Weigel Reliability Index.
They are.
Which
they're
says
very,
something.
Very reliable. Yeah. They've got, yeah, you know, the fundamentals for those rivers stack up really well. They're close enough, they're far enough south to get the benefit of rain that doesn't necessarily get further into the northeast. So they get the best of both worlds. They get the good rainfall coming down from the north, and they also get it coming from the south. So one of the things that works in the favour of the Stevo and the Rubicon and so forth is, man, they're so reliable for flows. I don't think I've ever found an emaciated Stevo or Rubicon in my fishing life. I've seen them low, but never low enough that I think, gosh, the fish may not survive this. Yeah. Whereas I've certainly seen that on rivers like the Rose and the Buffalo and, you know, some of those rivers further north and east. And again, you know, this is where you need to look at how your potential stream that you're planning to fish fits with the season. Now, the Rose can be an absolutely wonderful river in a wet year, but this year, forget about it, you know. That's a sort of really obvious example. But even a river like the Buckland, it's probably only recently, as in the last few weeks, that it's been a viable option, because it would have been too low and too warm through much of the middle part of the season. Ovens, much better, you know. It does well in dry years, comparatively speaking, especially if you get sort of bright and above. So again, you're just thinking through your conditions versus where you're planning to go. And I don't like bony rivers, basically. Rivers that look, if your river looks stressed, then the fishing is going to be tougher. So there's a difference between a river that's low and a river that's what I'd say bony, where you could just about drive your car up it. Yes, fish will hang on in rivers like that, but the actual fishing until the rain arrives is going to be pretty hard.
Yeah, that's it. And also, I think, like you mentioned about the snowies, is you had a few backup options if, you know, you couldn't fish the lake or vice versa. And that's the same with this Mary's or Lower Goulburn catchment, is you've got five or six.
That's one of the
rivers.
Appeals of it. You've it's got a lot great. Of a lot of options nearby. So one river I like to fish fairly often when I'm in that area is the Little River. Now, it's not been a good year for the Little River because it doesn't cope well with those low flows. Whereas the Rubicon, yeah, go for it. You know, it's good. So, and you the big rivers, you know, within striking distance. You're right, Pete. Options are a fantastic thing because it gives you choices if where you were planning to go doesn't quite play out the way you thought it would. But I just want to go back a moment. What you were saying about the Stevo being a less technical river, I'd agree with that. But I would say, when conditions are like they've been lately, I can't stress enough, you fish slow and careful. You're a ninja. The trout are going to be a lot more spooky in that those conditions. They're not going to move as far for your fly, and it may take you a few casts and a few drifts to get that sort of sweet spot where the fish is going to eat with nymph or dry fly. So, you know, don't go racing up the river looking for redemption. Walk, go slow. I've actually written about this in an upcoming Flystream article. Go slow, go careful. Same at Lake Eucanbeen when I was there in December. We didn't find fish by striding as fast as we could along the bank. We stopped, looked, got up high, looked carefully, waited. Then if we hadn't seen anything, moved a little bit further and repeated. I think impatience is your enemy in a year like we've just had. You're not going to find redemption around the next corner. You've got to fish carefully wherever you find those promising-looking bays or runs. Really carefully. Fish carefully and don't let the fish see you because they're going to be on high alert. Cormorants or no cormorants, fish in low, clear water are going to be on high alert because they know instinctively that they're more vulnerable than when it's cloudy and wet and rough.
So it sounds like the theme for this season has been slow it down, be adaptable, think outside the box, have your plans B and C. And we've just got so much to learn from that as anglers, and it's just going to make
I think that's a really, that's a pretty damn good summary. Be prepared. Fish slow. That, like, if you go slow, you see stuff too, Peter.
Yeah.
You know, if you go too fast, you don't see that fish that's rising once every 5 minutes under the bank, you know? And you've got to fish that water carefully. Like, you can't expect a fish to move 2 meters for your fly in the what were, it's all changing fast now because it's so cold, but what were the conditions a month ago? You know, they're really, like, Peter, Julian and I are fishing the ovens and we were seeing a lot of fish, but man, they were not going to move for your fly, you know. They were great fish. And if your drift was not perfect, if it was just, you had a little bit of drag, and you've got to be brutal with yourself about drag when the fish are a bit sort of skittish, your fly's got to be traveling the same speed as the bubbles, and believe me, I don't always get it right, but that means I just have to do another cast where I do get it right. You know, fish a longer leader. Sometimes the big flies are a bit too much, not always. Sometimes it's counterintuitive. The fish will sort of come up for a big fly when they won't come up for a little one, but yeah, sometimes when it's low and clear, you've got to use a little fly. And I think being adaptable is really important, both in terms of what you're fishing, like that dragonfly fishing, that was just, I've never done that before, ever in my life have I stripped a magoo across the Rubicon River in September near the surface to catch dragonfly feeders. So I just sort of adapted my lake fishing technique to what I was encountering on a fast-flowing mountain river. And it worked, fortunately, or it worked well enough. So that's a sort of an extreme example of being prepared to adapt. But you can't just put your hands on your hips and say, I only fish a royal wolf, mate.
Because in the bubble line.
It may not be the right flight. I love royal wolves, by the way, and caught a lot of fish on them even this
year. And copper johns too,
probably. Maybe a little bit smaller than my normal royal wolves, maybe more your sort of size 14 royal wolves rather than your sort of size 10 or 12. So, yeah, be prepared to adapt. F flies, little spinners. I'll tell you one thing that's just astonishes me in years like this. It's how far a little fly can be seen by a trout. We totally, and I'm guilty of this after more decades than I care to admit to, that I just don't think, I have this thing, this little childish thought in my head, if my fly is too little, the fish won't notice it. But if they want to eat it, they'll notice it, you know.
Mm.
They'll move for it and they'll eat it, you know. So
they're well adapted.
It's a good year for fishing an ant pattern up the Delatite sometimes rather than the little royal wolf.
For sure. And Phil, look, the other thing that has really stood out to me in chatting to you is this talk about the fundamentals. And that's something that I feel like we've really just looked at on the surface in this chat, and would love to dig a bit deeper into that at some point with you. But considering those fundamentals as to where you should go, it's almost like some kind of Warren Buffett investment strategy. It is.
Well, it is. And Andrew, I think this might be where social media has done us a bit of a disservice.
Yeah.
So I dare say the Jim Allen, for want of a better word, cohort, without who did all their fishing in their 20s and 30s without the benefit of social media, they probably relied upon, and I have to ask Jim about this, I bet you they relied more on the fundamentals than we do today. You know, people want that quick and easy fix of clicking, has anybody fished the Steve-O lately? You know, they want that sort of easy sort of freeway to the good goss. But I found that's a pretty flimsy way to find good fishing, to be perfectly honest, for the reasons we've been over and over and over, which is that basically mostly those sorts of chats are a pile on, especially when it comes to the negative. You know, if you put up on social media, I'm going to Tasmania in January, where should I fish? Half the comments that would have come back would have been, don't bother. Is that a fair comment?
Yeah, definitely.
100%.
Mm.
Yeah, and it's just nonsense. It's just absolute nonsense. It was not don't bother. There was fantastic fishing there. We caught hundreds of fish on our trip. Was it lots of fish everywhere, any method? Of course not. Were the dunhatches below par? Yes, they were. Was there a lack of beetles? Yeah. What was the midge fishing like? Off the charts. What was the polaroiding like on some of the lakes? Fantastic. What was the, you know, that there was terrestrial fishing. There was lots and lots of good fishing. So, you know, you're not going to get that on social media because the people who aren't catching anything, I hate to say it, can't wait to
tell people how bad it is.
Agree with each other.
It can become such an echo dome. I think that's the issue with social media. It's just, like you said, with the positive fishing, it just piles on worse and worse and worse, and then everyone gets this thought on their head.
It's a two-edged sword, Pete. Yeah, it's we could have a very long debate whether we're even better off with it or without it. So
wrong podcast.
But I think I try to go to the fundamentals. So when I go and investigate, as I'm doing now, I'm investigating various lakes. I'm not reading a single report before I go. So I'm trying not to be, if you like, tainted by what I'm reading, good or bad. So when I go and explore the Grampians Lakes for the first time once the weather cools down, or, you know, Newlyn Hepburn, Tullaroop, et cetera, I'm trying not to be influenced by what I've read, good or bad. I'm just trying to look at what the last year has brought and then trying to go and investigate it myself and see what I find. You know,
Phil, so, let's touch on that before we wrap it up. What is the outlook like for the rest of your river fishing season, if there is any more river fishing for you in the next few weeks?
Look, I reckon it'd be okay. Like, normally I would have given up by now, and I probably won't go back to the rivers. I'm not, never say never. But because we've had such an extended warm period, I think it may have skewed the season. So my mate JD, he was fishing to quite good hatches on the Goulburn yesterday, little duns,
nice.
In places, not everywhere, but the river's low and so forth. And I think there's probably similar to be found on some of the, natural freestone streams. But, yeah, to be perfectly honest, Andrew, I'm probably not going to go back up because it's sort of my sort of fishing clock, if you like, is ticking over to lake fishing and estuaries again. So that's not because I won't catch anything on the rivers. It's just that's where I'm at. But, yeah, I think if you had a crack at the Goulburn or something, especially you could expect pretty good fishing during the warmer part of the day at least.
And your lakes, how are they shaping up for our winter?
Yeah, good. So I went for a drive around the lakes yesterday, the local lakes. They're low as. Some of them need a decent drink, like Newlyn and Hepburn. I was amazed at Hepburn. I thought Hepburn would be a write-off. This is where it sometimes pays just to go and look. It was actually in pretty good shape, you know. I didn't stay long, so I didn't catch any fish in it. I did catch one in Newlyn. And they're low, but I guess the bottom line is there's still more than enough water for a fish. Tullaroop, stacks of water. You know, that's not even looking much different than it normally does.
How's the clarity in Tullaroop?
Just chugging along. Moorabool, yeah, not bad. Saw a couple of smelters. Didn't stay long either because it was more about going for a drive and a checkout than anything else. But besides Wenderee and Tullaroop, yeah, they could all do with some rain. There's no doubt about that. And I hope we get it. But, yeah, and I was down at Bullamerri not long ago, Parambit not long ago. They're fine. You know, business as usual. We can't launch a boat at Parambit, but I fish it from the shore anyway myself. Yeah, so there's plenty of lake options out there.
The outlook is pretty good for winter, eh? Sounds great.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. And the estuary fishing's just been fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, so that's I'll be doing plenty of that.
Yeah, good. Nice. Yeah.
Brim and EPs and maybe even, dare I speak its name, a Mulloway.
Yeah, the ghost.
Oops, I shouldn't have said that. I'll moz myself.
Great, mate. Well, yeah, thanks for our five-minute chat. It never is 5 minutes, you know, because there's just so much.
Sorry about that.
So much knowledge and just so much that we love hearing from you, Phil. So thank you so much, mate.
No worries. Pleasure.
Thanks, Phil.
Oh, so good, hey, hearing from him.
It's like hearing from the Oracle.
That man, he's just got so much knowledge, you know. It's crazy every time we speak to him. He's, he is the Oracle, as you say. So thank you, Phil. Really appreciate that chat, man, as always. And no doubt that the listeners got a fair bit out of that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, like we really covered quite a bit there and it became pretty clear that Phil, he doesn't just fluke these things. He has a bit of a system in place, doesn't he?
Absolutely. I think Phil's one of those guys that understands that sometimes we need to look at the fundamentals of our fishing and the variables we can look at and analyze and have some control over. So you check the stream flow for all the rivers in Victoria, not just the one you want to go to, and you pick the one that looks the best on paper.
Yeah, and the real value of a fishing report too. I really like that.
And a reliable fishing report, not a Facebook forum post.
Yeah. Yeah, or you know, from a friend of a friend or but then those reports that do carry a bit of credibility still carrying quite a bit of weight too, such as those ones that are published at Flystream at the flyfisher.com.au. So, it's still worthwhile getting that information, but geez, there's nothing that compares to actually getting out there and doing it. Maybe having a list of your own fundamentals that you think are important for the conditions and just really nutting it out, thinking about your fishing rather than being the spoilt fly fisher that we have been.
Absolutely. I think this season's been a real wake-up call for everyone, including us.
Totally.
Yeah. We were spoilt, you know. At one stage, you could flop your fly anywhere in a river in northeast Victoria and you'd catch a trout.
Yeah. And look, there's no doubt that there was a pretty huge influx of new fly fishers during that time. And our hope is that we can give you the information you need to continue that success that you've hopefully had over the last few seasons. So, obviously, if we can ever help, we are in the shop and always publishing material like this podcast in the hope that we're helping you with your fishing. Be more adaptable. Work at it. I think we're definitely going to get Phil back on to talk more about those fundamentals because
that was gold.
I wonder if he'll give up all the seat. I reckon he will. He's pretty generous.
He's so generous.
Isn't he?
So generous.
He could keep all that to himself if he wanted to.
There's no talking to Phil and he's like, oh, I'm not going to tell you that.
No, he's a true gentleman and a great ambassador for fly fishing. We've got plenty more in store at the Fly Fishers podcast coming up. So stay tuned as always and appreciate your patience with us getting this one out. It has been a little bit of time between
drinks.
Bit of a
break. Yes, it has been.
But hopefully worth the wait. Thank you, Philip. And stay tuned for the next episode. Cheers.